Okay, so thank you very much. Yeah, take the opportunity to thank the organizers for the wonderful session and the opportunity to talk. So what I'm going to talk about here is mostly work in progress, which I've been doing with Murat Gunaydin, Andy Nitsky, and Andrew Waldron. This is based on some earlier work I did over the summer, but most of the material I will be presenting is new and published, and therefore has loose ends and probably statements that need refinements. Okay, so this is the short title is The Quantum Attractor Mechanism. The longer title is this one. I didn't give it because I don't want to scare off the audience. But what I plan to do is talk about black hole degeneracies and try to produce some formula which potentially would give the exact degeneracies for black holes with given charges in certain supersymmetric theories. And this will involve discussing, it turns out, the quantum attractor flow, which will be related to geodesic motion, to the subject of unipotent representations, automorphic forms, and if I have time, I'll get to this final idyllic wave function of the universe. So, in fact, my talk will be coordinated in some way with the talk of Murat on Friday, so I won't be able to give all the mathematical details, and hopefully between the two of us, you'll have the full picture as we understand it now. So I'll start with some brief review and motivation why we're doing this. So it's a very challenging problem to understand the microscopic origin of this black hole entropy. And string theory is quite famous for reproducing this answer to leading order by assuming that the microstates are effectively weakly coupled open strings around some D-Rank configurations that carries the same charges as the black hole. But I think it's fair to say that this is really has been demonstrated only in the thermodynamical limit, where the area is much bigger than the Newton constant, where equivalently the black holes are very large charges. And this agreement is not so much sensitive to the detailed microscopic dynamics. It basically relies on the central charge of some conformal field theory. So it's an important question for string theory to try and determine whether it holds beyond leading order. Now, there's been quite some progress on this issue recently, and I'm not going to cover it all, but just the one relevant for me. From the microscopic point of view, the corrections to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy due to higher derivative interactions have been worked out to some extent, in particular including some so-called F-term interactions in n equal 2 supergravity, which are the ones that can be computed using the topological string. And this is not certainly the whole set of interactions, but there is some hope that this will be sufficient knowledge to understand the field of EDS states. So if we are not interested in the exact degeneracies, but some kind of index, then we hope at least that this would be sufficient. Now, there was also some progress on the microscopic side. Well, one of the earlier works where its corrections to this Cardi formula could be worked out was the M5 brain realization of n equal to black holes by Maldacena-Witt and Strominger. Now there are more techniques available, quiver gauge theories, for example, or using the recently understood 4D, 5D lift to use knowledge from five-dimensional black holes to understand the degeneracies of four-dimensional black holes, which I'll be concentrating on. But in bridging between microscopics and macroscopics, we need one more piece of information, which is what kind of thermodynamical ensemble is the system put into. And for this, again, there is a recent conjecture by Oguri, Strominger, Vaffa, that this ensemble, which is implicit in the Bekenstein-Hawking wall computation, relying on this framework, is in fact a mixed ensemble where the black holes have a fixed magnetic charge, but the electric charge is free to fluctuate at some potential phi a. So putting those pieces together, especially putting 1 and 3 together, Oguri, Strominger, and Vaffa have produced a very puzzling conjecture. which relates the microscopic degenerates omega pq to the topological string amplitude psi, which governs those psi derivative interactions. And the way it can be written in two essentially equivalent ways. One is that the microscopic degeneracies, or a suitably defined index, is given by the Laplace transform of the modulus square of this topological string amplitude. Or equivalently, if you inverse the Laplace transform, the partition function of the black hole microstates at a given potential phi, electric potential phi, is given by the square of the topological amplitude. It's actually not quite the square. If you're careful about contours, what you find it's a sum of translates of the product psi star. But this is really not so important. This just is accounted for by the contour that you pick here. Now, has been somewhat of an open question, what was the level of validity of this conjecture. I think it was first proposed, I think it is proposed as an equality to all orders in an expansion at large charge, by which I mean rescaling all the charges with the same rate, taking lambda to infinity. But possibly by understanding the non-perturbative completion of this object, one may be able to make sense of it not only in an asymptotic expansion, but this will involve resolving many problems such as specifying the contour, making sure exactly what index is computed on that side, and so on and so forth. So rather than the OSV conjecture, I will use the OSV fact for most for the purposes of my talk, which is a very nice restatement of the Bekenstein-Hawking computation in this supergravity, in the quantum supergravities, namely at the semi-classical level, this formula is approximated by doing a saddle point approximation here, where you can see that the saddle point phi is such that the values of the moduli xa, so this is the quantity in the parentheses here, as well as its electromagnetic dual, so to speak, are fixed by the attractor equations to the charges, the magnetic charges P and electric charges Q. So that's a classical statement, a well-known attractor equation that fixes the moduli as you look at your black hole and follow the geometry inward to the horizon. So this is the saddle point, and the value at the saddle point is just the Legendre transform of the exponent. And so the statement is that the entropy in this approximation is the Legendre transform of the object in the exponent, which you may call the free energy. And this indeed is just the way people have computed the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy at tree level. Now, this also holds by including higher instanton corrections to F as well as higher genus contributions, but I won't be discussing them in my talk. We'll be focusing on a tree-level topological amplitude. So now, if it is true, then the OSV conjecture implies, on top of the corrections to the entropy already predicted by this formula, they imply further corrections. The first of them being logarithmic in the charges and coming simply from the one-loop measure, the one-loop contribution in the semi-classical expansion, but there is, of course, an infinite sum of such terms, plus even exponentially suppressed corrections. So this conjecture has been checked in many ways, and I'm not going to review them. That's not the subject of my talk. I just mentioned a piece of work that we did with Greg last summer, where we studied a class of small black holes for which we actually know what the microscopic degeneracies are, because those are dual to heterotic states, and we know, perturbative heterotic states, and we know how to count them. And we did find some beautiful agreement, as well as a number of unresolved subtleties, especially in A equal to or before models. So it's not the subject of my talk to elaborate on those. Rather, what I would like to do is rephrase this conjecture in terms terms of the attractor, in terms of the quantum attractor flow in the black hole, and then try to develop this line. So this OSV, in this integral form, this OSV relation can be written in the following way. You can bring in the dependence on the charges, PQ, into a redefined topological amplitude psi, which is just the action of the original one by a shift and multiplication by a phase, in such a way that this just appears as the overlap between two wave functions in a Hilbert space. And this, as was already noticed in the OSV and further elaborated upon by a paper by Ogori, Vafaf, and Linder, this is very much reminiscent of open-closed duality in the cylinder. So this is some inner product between two states. And let me say a little more. Well, so the analog of the boundary state in the open string cylinder computation is this topological string state over here. The analog of the trace in the open string channel is the number of states for the given black hole. And of course, for this analogy to make sense, you want the actual Hamiltonians to vanish, because there is no extra parameter T in this formula. But this is something which is actually quite natural. So the way, sort of the hand-waving way of understanding this conjecture now, is that we should think of the black hole geometry in its new horizon, ADS2 cross S2, as a space with two boundaries. So ADS2 in global coordinates as this structure with time going upward, which is actually time is actually periodic, but you can take the infinite cover. And then you can consider two kind of quantization in this geometry. I hope this can be read for people on the side. The interesting quantization which will give us the Hilbert space of the actual black holes is with respect to the global time in ADS2. So this is the time on the ADS2 boundary. So that's kind of the open string time in the gauge theory. But nothing prevents us from doing an alternative quantization, some radial quantization. Even though this is not a Killing vector, it's still a well-defined slicing of the geometry. And so the relation between the two would be by this channel duality, where we should take the inner product of a wave function associated to the two boundaries. And by this channel duality, this would be related to the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in global time. So that's the idea. And of course, the fact that the Hamiltonians vanish is just a consequence of diffeomorphism invariance in gravity. The Wheeler-DeWitt equation tells us that in either case, the Hamiltonian should vanish. So the topological amplitude is then understood as the wave function of this radial attractor flow. And well, if you want to think of radius as time, this would be some kind of wave function of the universe. That was the.
And you get the ADS2 vector.
Yeah, that's right. So.
And you're not flowing.
Yeah, you're not flowing. But the picture I will advocate is that you should actually take the complete geometry, including the asymptotic infinity, and take channel duality in the full geometry. I agree that in principle there is enough information in the near horizon geometry to characterize all the states. So this is the goal of my talk is to perform this radial quantization of black holes in this supersymmetric setting. Now, of course, I should say that this is not a new idea. There was quite a bit of work on that in the gRQC literature. starting from Cavalier, Diafoe, Filipov, and several others. And I don't think it led really anywhere then. But I think the novelty here is, once for one, that we're working in a supersymmetric context. And so it may be, again, there's a lot of wishful thinking, but it may be sufficient to restrict ourselves to this mini-superspace truncation and just look at spherically symmetric configurations. Now, the second item, which I think wasn't taken into account in the earlier canonical gravity attempts, is this channel duality between in the near-horizon geometry.
Don't we know from split fractal flows that
it's considered? Yeah, I think so. I think it's a very important question, how to extend this to multi-centered black holes. So what I will not present a complete story, and it could be that the fine details of the black hole degenerations need this to be taken into account. So we'll do just one thing at a time. So, well, if this kind of interpretation is correct, there is also one further question, which is, well, we can specify some wave functions at the two boundaries, but which one should we pick? And should we pick the same on the two boundaries? And so I will give a principle for which wave function to pick, which using, I mean, with in such that it will give rise to degeneracies in agreement with duality. So this is the outline of my talk. I will try to clarify this conjecture by considering situation with a high level of symmetry. So in particular, I will be discussing n equal 8 and n equal 4 supergravity, but I'll also be touching upon n equal 2 supergravities for the very special ones, that is the ones whose moduli space is actually a symmetric space. And we can use all the techniques of representation theory to understand what is going on. Now, the true story will involve string theory and Calabi-Yau. Moduli space is much more complicated. There's corrections. So this is only a first step in this study. So the way we're going to do this is to reinterpret the radial evolution equations as some geodesic motion on a scalar manifold, which arises by compactification from four dimensions to three dimensions. That's because we're looking at stationary black holes. And once we have this classical understanding, we can go on and quantize the system by the usual procedure of quantizing geodesic motion, which is to replace classical trajectories by functions on the space in which the particle lives. Now, we're actually interested not into the full Hilbert space, but the BPS Hilbert space. And so we'll have to understand some somewhat unusual representations of the symmetry group, which is where the connection to unipotent representations will come up. Now, before we get lost in the details, let me just summarize the main message, I hope, of my talk, which is that beyond the four-dimensional U-duality symmetry, under which the black hole degeneracies should be invariant, there will be, in fact, a larger spectrum-generating symmetry, which is the three-dimensional U-duality group in three dimensions, which acts on this black hole wave function. And this symmetry will give us a way to select the appropriate state at the two boundaries in such a way that the Fourier coefficients that we extract have the right invariance property. So, by the way, interrupt me at any time. So here's the plan. I'll start by reviewing some facts about black hole entropy in these special models. Relate attractive flow to geodesic motion, quantize it, and then try to make it invariant on the U-duality. Okay, so let me review a few facts already about n equal 4 supergravity or string theory. So we have this kind of moduli space depending on how many vector multiplets we have. And the black hole entropy is usually given by the square root of a quartic invariant, which is built out of the magnetic and electric charges. And this is magnificently invariant under the action of the two duality groups at the continuous level. But of course, the exact degeneracies will not be invariant under that symmetry. And there was, in fact, a proposal earlier on by DVV who related this, proposed to relate those degeneracies to the Fourier coefficients of a modular form of the group SP4, which is the genus 2 modular group. And it's actually supported now by more evidence coming from this 5D, 4D lift, 4D, 5D lift. And so this also reproduces the right entropy to leading order in the charges. But it relies on a somewhat unexpected symmetry, which is this SP4 here. So the invariance under the T-duality group SO622 is just evident because only the square of the charges appear. But the invariance under the S-duality part SL2 is realized by embedding this inside SP4. But really, there isn't so far any physical understanding what this symmetry means. So what I will propose in this case is that the correct group that underlies the black hole degeneracies is in fact the three-dimensional U-duality group, which for those particular cases is SO8 and V+2. And this should also, of course, should reproduce this answer in the regime of overlap, but I would like to claim that the exact answer is provided by this type of counting function, and in particular, the true answer will not be a function only of the square of charges, but will involve more subtle invariants. So let me also mention n equals 8. There, the U-duality symmetry is E7. We have 56 charges on which E7 is linearly acting. And the entropy is given by the square root of this quartic invariant of the 56, which I displayed here for definiteness. And again, this is invariant under the continuous group. But one expects, in principle, at least some dependence on the finer details of the charges. So I don't want to spend much time on that because it's not the main point of my talk, but using again this 4D, 5D lift, for a given class of black holes, we can relate, for a certain orbit of the U-duality, we can relate the exact degeneracies to Fourier coefficients of some Jacobi form, which arises in the counting of five-dimensional black holes. But again, this is only a function of this quartic invariant, and I think this is only part of the answer, which at the end of the day, so in this particular case, n equals 8 would be given by some automorphic form of the three-dimensional U-duality group E8. Now, I mentioned this very special n equal 2 supergravities. Mohat will actually give a lot more detail about them in his talk on Friday. But let me just say that this is an interesting class where the moduli space is a symmetric space. The tree level, the prepotential is purely tree level, is a cubic part. And it is such spaces are classified by this cubic polynomial. Those are constant coefficients. And they can be associated to Jordan algebras of degree 3, where this n of x becomes the norm of this Jordan algebra, which is roughly like the determinant of a 3x3 matrix. And for those spaces, the moduli space in four dimensions is simply obtained from various symmetric groups of the Jordan algebra. And rather than explaining you the symbols, I'll just give a quick list of what you get in this case. So you get two generic families. This is familiar from heterotic on K3. And this is the exceptional family, which involves in particular in four dimensions an exceptional supergravity, which also has a E7 type of symmetry, but in a different real form. And those supergravities are not really, I mean, it's not clear at this stage, I think, whether they really make sense as string theories. They do arise in the untwisted sectors of some orbifolds. The exceptional ones. Yeah. But even this one usually will have corrections.
Well, for the
FHSV. But for FHSV, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's right. But so, despite the fact that there may not be full string theories, they certainly have the structure we expect for supergravity, and so we can use the representation theory techniques to understand how this OSV conjecture should really be framed. So a quick remark I want to make about this very special supergravity, which will turn out to play an important role later on, is that this cubic prepotential is not any cubic, and in fact it satisfies the amusing property that it is invariant. So if you consider this cubic polynomial over x0, it's in fact invariant under Legendre transform in all the variables. That's a funny bit of mathematics, which follows from the adjoint identity of Jordan algebras. So let's consider this cubic over x0 had conjugate parameters to x0 and xa, and extremized with respect to x0 and xa. We get the Legendre transform of this object. Turns out that it has the same shape as the original object you started with. It's in if and only if. That is, that there is in fact a classification of those cubic polynomials which are invariant under Legendre by those people, which coincides with the Jordan algebra classification. But in fact, there is a stronger statement that the exponential of this object is in fact invariant under Fourier transform. So this is really an exact semiclassical approximation. Now, the reason I bring this up is to demonstrate how this OSV fact works out in the case of very special supergravities. So we're instructed to compute the free energy as a function of magnetic charges and electric potentials. So if you plug in the prepotential, this is the kind of object you find. And I'm not going to give you the details, but by performing, so OSV at the semiclassical level instructs us to perform the Legendre transform of this object with respect to the phis. And you can actually reduce that to the problem I just mentioned here to write down the answer here. So this what you get is in fact the square root of a quartic polynomial, which you recognize as being the quartic invariant of the relevant u-duality group. This is this gives us some kind of supergravity realization of an identity of which is well known in the theory of Jordan algebras. And in the intermediate step of the computation, what you actually get is the entropy of an equivalent five-dimensional black hole. So this generalizes this 4D, 5D lift, which was discussed by Gaiotto, Strominger, and Yin to the framework of N equals 4, N equals 8, and N equals 2. I should say that Yin will give a talk next week. He will discuss more, I think, this issue. So this is just to illustrate the fact that the OSV proposal actually makes sense also for these very special supergravities and for N equal 4, N equals 8. And in fact, the way to summarize this is that it goes through as if you define the N equals 8 topological amplitude as the exponential of the prepotential, where the prepotential now is this cubic invariant of E6 for n equals 8, or this this prepotential, this quadratic times linear prepotential for n equals 4 symmetry. So in either of those two cases, the five-dimensional, this is invariant under the five-dimensional utility group, but by applying this procedure, you get an invariant under the four-dimensional utility group, which is acting non-linearly on this topological amplitude. Right. Here I've been focusing on the tree-level part of the potential. Okay, so. Yeah, so for, well, for n equals 8, there would be exact in the sense that there would be no R-square corrections, no FGs, but it's still conceivable, I think, that other kind of topological amplitudes, like R to the 4, H to the 4G minus 4, could give a contribution, could correct the black hole entropy. Right. Right. I mean, I think it's still not clear why we expect only the topological amplitude to contribute. All right, so this was mostly warm-up material. Now I'm going to the crux of the problem, which is to quantize this attractor flow. So we're interested in stationary solutions in four dimensions. And so for them, we can use a Kendall-Zeclin type of ansatz, where the function u, the metric in three dimensions, and the components of the gauge fields depend only on the spatial coordinates, but not on time. And it's well known that if you reduce the four-dimensional Einstein equation and Einstein Maxwell in four dimensions to three, what you get is a 3D gravity plus only scalars, because all the gauge fields can be dualized into scalars. So you have some nonlinear sigma model on the target space, which I denote M3 star.
Hang on. Do you know there's no trim Simons?
There are no trim Simons terms in three dimensions. Well, I know that. Yeah, there would be. So, I mean, there are three-dimensional supergravities which do have trim Simons, but those do not come from four dimensions, I think. I know that in those cases there are none. If you don't have any in four dimensions, you don't get any in three. But well, all the gauge fields have been dualized into scalars. I don't know how you could write down the transcendental term. And there is a formalism where you keep the two. And
I think the statement is simply if you take the four-dimensional Einstein Maxwell and reduce, you notice that there are no transcendental terms.
There's not really any origin for them. If there was some F wedge F terms in four dimensions, maybe.
If you reduce
11 dimensional supergravity, you don't get some. Okay, well, so there are no gauge fields in two dimensions. Yeah. So, well, this is actually a statement that goes back to Brighton, Lohner, Gibbons, and Mason, who give a complete list of these three-dimensional modulized spaces that you get. That's a fact.
I thought somebody
would
reduce from 11 to 1 to 5.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You will get
okay.
So on the tutorial of a
classification,
you have a number of objects. They have a circle.
So we get some target space M3, and I denoted it M3 star because that's not the one you usually get by reduction on a space-like circle. It's in fact is an analytic continuation thereof, where you multiply by I the gauge terms essentially. In particular, it has an indefinite metric. Furthermore, it has a bunch of isometries 2n plus 2, which are associated to the to the gauge symmetries of your gauge fields and their magnetic dual in four dimensions, as well as the gauge symmetry of the dual to this Kaluza-Klein gauge field, which is the knot or twist potential. That's 2n plus 1. And then you could also rescale the time coordinate, that is shift u, that gives an extra one. And it's interesting that these Killing vector fields satisfy a non-trivial algebra. This is an Heisenberg algebra. The magnetic shifts and the electric shifts do not commute, but they close on, they commute only to the knot charge. And furthermore, the rescalings also do not commute with the electric and magnetic charges. They rescale them. And later on, this I will show that those objects are in fact just the electric charge, magnetic charge, knot charge, and the knot charge and the ADM mass of the black hole. So those quantities in three dimensions, as long as the knot charge is non-zero, will not commute. So we have to take that into account if we quantize the system. So for example, if we reduce n equals 8 Segre, this is the space-like reduction, but the time-like reduction changes the group downstairs. If you reduce n equal 4 Segre, again, you get a sigma model where the group downstairs is not the maximally compact subgroup of the group upstairs, and therefore the manifold has indefinite signature. For the generic... Yeah, so it's a very good question to which I will come back later. But if we want to enforce quantization of the charges, we certainly have to divide out by some Borel subgroup of the U-duality group. And I will claim that if you want to reproduce, to have a formula which makes sense under the discrete U-duality, the four-dimensional U-duality, it is very natural to divide out by the three-dimensional U-duality group.
But if you divide those spaces by the
U-duality group, we're going to good point. So indeed, you can think of this space as being kind of the boundary to that space, and so the action is not ergodic. So in fact, we'll be quantizing, we'll be doing analytic continuation.
You're going to go back to M3?
Yeah, eventually.
Why did you go to M star in the first place?
Because that's what the classical physics tell you this is what you have to do. Because, I have a black hole which is stationary in time, so I reduce a long time.
Right. You're reducing a long time direction.
Yeah, that's right. This is the main point here. Yeah. Right. Okay. So if you're not interested in n equals 4, n equals 8, but only in n equals 2, then this would still go through. What you would get is a quaternionic Keller manifold, which would be obtained from your four-dimensional modelized space, which is special Keller, by the CMAP procedure, according to Ferrara-Sabroval. And that's for space-like reduction, but for time-like reduction, you still need to do this analytic continuation. That's what's called paracatenonic Keller, but that's just a name. Okay? So here's the list of all the groups that you get. This is what you get by space-like reduction, and this is by time-like reduction. So as you can see in all cases, the group downstairs is non-compact and is related to the by a simple analytic continuation to the one in the space-like case. Okay, now, so far this was only stationary. Now let's assume spherical symmetry. Our three-dimensional metric can be put in this ansatz. I'll keep the lapse variable n for convenience. And if I reduce the sigma model action, then what I get is just the Lagrangian for a particle on a cone. Well, a particle living on the manifold M3 star, this is this piece, times r. So this is the cone metric on that space. And of course, the Lagrangian multiplier n forces the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, that is the Hamiltonian of that system, should vanish at the classical level. So what we deduce is that the solutions, spherically symmetric stationary solutions, are just massive geodesics on this cone. And that separates into geodesic motion on M3 star times motion along this r direction. I want h equals, if you eliminate that, you actually get h equals.
Is there a misprint here? Do you want minus m squared or do you want equals m squared?
Okay, I don't know. I think this is correct. No, I think this is correct. Okay, what's not correct? Okay, the sign is, yeah, you're right. This is not quite the sign. There should be a plus sign here. Well.
No, but I'm really confused about it. You want the relative equation to be h equals 0?
Let's see.
I think.
Well, let's see. You're right. No, if I vary n, then I get this expression equals n squared. I mean, this is. So if I was okay. Yeah. So I should first go to Hamiltonian. This 1/n will become the n upstairs, and then I will get p squared minus that plus 1 times n squared. Okay. So this is 1. Well, that's okay. It's not. We can sort this out. So, okay. So this is what we have. If we did not assume spherical symmetry, what we would have instead is not massive. It's not geodesic motion, but harmonic maps from three dimensions to this manifold. So that's what would be relevant for the multi-centered black hole case. You want me to sort this out now, or? There's a 1 here.
H equals 0.
Well, the relative weight equation is whatever you get by eliminating n, right? So. Okay. So because we had this algebra of this isometries on your manifold, we get conserved natural charges, and they satisfy a Poisson algebra, which is the same as that of the vector fields. So what we discover is that indeed the magnetic and electric charges do not commute, but they close only to the net charge. However, that's not so so serious, because the only bona fide four-dimensional black holes arise only when this net charge is equal to 0. If it's not 0, then there is a Kaluza-Klein term in the 4D metric, which implies that the phi direction is compact and becomes time-lag at infinity. So those manifolds have closed time-lag curves, so they're not really interested physically. But I will nevertheless argue that it's interesting to keep into account this extra charge, because it greatly extends the symmetry. And we can always get back to k equals 0 at the end of the day by taking the limit, k equals 0.
What would be the problem physically?
Well, you wouldn't be able to,
specify.
You would have a particle for which you cannot measure both the electric and magnetic charge in four dimensions. That would be somewhat unusual. Okay. 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 So now, in addition to this, let me skip this part, which is not so important, at least at this stage. So these are all the solutions to the stationary spherically symmetric solutions. However, we're interested only in the supersymmetric ones. And one condition you need to impose for supersymmetry is that the slices, the three-dimensional slices, should be flat. Sorry. So if they are flat, that means you can take r equals rho in this equation, since this was 1 here, this cancels out, and you're just left with a massless geodesic on this three-dimensional manifold. So that's a necessary condition for supersymmetry. The geodesic on M3 star should be light-like. But in fact, there will be many more constraints which are important. So, well, at least I should be able to relate what I just said to the ordinary statement of the attractor flow. And in fact, you can do that. You can show that the geodesic motion on this special quaternionic color manifold that you get in three dimensions for general n equals 2 is actually equivalent to the attractor flow equations that we're on. I don't really want to give many details. This will require going into quaternionic geometry. But the crux is that the metric can be defined by some kind of quaternionic field bind, which essentially specifies what are the fermion variations for the particle, the superparticle propagating on this manifold. And if you require the fermion variation to be zero, then that puts a condition on this field bind that it should have a zero eigenvector. And you can rewrite those conditions just in terms of the various coordinates. And here you'll recognize, if you set k equal to zero, you recognize the usual attractor flow equations. Now, this was in fact this analogy, or this equivalence between attractor flow and geodesic motion on quaternionic spaces, was first observed by Guperli and Spalinsky, who studied spherically symmetric d-instantons. And in fact, it's a reflection of mirror symmetry. Those d-instantons are dual to our black holes. Nevertheless, I think it's the most appropriate way of understanding the attractor equations as geodesic flow. And it furthermore suggests how you could incorporate higher derivative corrections into this formalism. Of course, you could just reduce them in this Kaluza-Klein-Ansatz as I did at tree level. But you could also remember that in four dimensions, mirror symmetry takes this FH amplitudes to F tilde H, which only depend on the hypers now and involves some higher derivative of the hypermultiplets in four dimensions. And if you reduce that to three dimensions, that's straightforward, and that tells you what is the form of the corrections to the geodesic motion that you will expect from higher derivative corrections. But I won't say more about them in this talk. So, let's see. So I think there was a lot of formalism, so it may be good to look at an explicit example and see how this goes on. So let's just look at the universal sector where we only keep two charges, the graviphoton charges, the scale U and the net charge K. Turns out that the manifold you have to consider in this case is the universal hypermultiplet manifold, that is SU2, 1 mod SU2 cross U1. Or rather, mod SL2 cross U1, because so we have M3 star with SU2, 1 SL2. Okay. And so you can easily solve for the motion. These zeta tilde variables corresponding to the gauge fields are just like the coordinates of a charged particle in a constant magnetic field, so it's the Landau problem. So this takes a constant value, and then you're just left with a motion in this potential of the U variable in this potential.
And these are ultimately the dynamics of the phi form of the tridimensional field dynamics.
I guess that's one way of understanding them. Yeah. Okay. So essentially, the potential looks like this. So, yeah. like this. This is for k equals 0, k different from 0. And this is the u variable, and this is the horizon, and this is infinity. Well, the infinity sits here. And so the ADS2 geometry is recovered just from motion in this region, which is independent of the details of that charge.
Zeta and zeta tilde are the
5 point. Right.
K is the constant.
K is the Kaluza line. K is the twist
then you
field.
Have U.
And U is the size of the circle. That's right.
So, what are you plotting?
So I'm plotting the effective potential for the U variable.
Ah, I see.
Yeah.
So what are you putting at some lambda level for?
Yeah. So you choose some lambda level for here. And
so you're taking the inner product of the Hamiltonian and so
lambda level, lowest lambda level? I'm doing it classically at the moment.
You're doing it classically?
Yeah. The whole point is to quantize. Okay, so if you do this, you can convince yourself that you recover the usual black hole solutions with the non-zero in that charge K. Okay. But now we have this whole motion on a particular space which has all the symmetries, and so it has many conserved charges. The Hamiltonian is just the Casimir of the symmetry, and there is an extra. It turns out that the extra Casimir vanishes by off shell in this system. So in this simple case, the condition of supersymmetry is quite simple because this 2x2 matrix has a zero eigenmode only if its determinant is zero, and this can just be seen by, so this is just the same as asking the geodesic to be like, no further condition, and indeed you see by rewriting the Hamiltonian as sum of squares that this is just equivalent to the attractor equation, that this should be equal to that. That gives you the supersymmetric solution. Now this is a very special case, but for all those I'm going a little too fast here, I'm sorry, I'm a little rushed by time, I guess. So a general trajectory in this system would have some value for the Hamiltonian and zero value for this higher Casimir. But as I require the supersymmetry, you see that you're fixing the value of the Casimir, and so you're looking at a particular noted charge, which turns out to be a nilpotent element. So we have a 3x3 matrix. If it satisfies, if the choice is zero and the determinant is zero, then it satisfies QQ equals zero. Now that's in fact a general statement for these motions on the symmetric spaces, namely the conserved noted charges have to be a nilpotent element of the algebra of symmetries. So this is the BPS. This is the BPS phase space that we are going to try and quantize. So the Suzy phase space is an nilpotent quadrant orbit of the symmetric group.
So I'm getting lost.
Yeah.
So what's the phase space you're going to quantize? Say it again. So it's the space of Qs.
The space of Qs subject to
at
this.
At Q is an operator acting on some
relative state. Okay, so.
What is Q?
Q is the other conserved charges for the geodesic motion on this symmetric space. Okay. So they live in the Lie algebra.
Q is a 3x2
matrix. Yeah. So it's an element of the Lie algebra, and I'm saying that the
algebra. You're still doing SU2-1.
So that's actually for all these very special supergravities that I mentioned. Okay. So this condition implies that the geodesic is light-like, but it is much more stringent, and in fact it is equivalent to requiring supersymmetry. Yeah. But, well.
Okay, so sorry, could you sum it up? So you're defining some special program of G3. What was G3? G3 is the space where you're getting your scalar math function. So M star is G3.
Yes. So this is G3 mod G3.
Okay. Then you look at it, how it's going on there.
So,
so let me
try to say it more clearly. So, we have geodesic motion on some symmetric space. It is integrable. It has some conserved charges that take value in the Lie algebra of that symmetric group. Now, I'm saying that supersymmetry picks out particular orbits of this noted charge. Yeah, and those are defined by this condition of being nilpotent. Of order 5. So this is an algebraic equation on the various coefficients in this
and
this
matrix. And a geodesic on that orbit corresponds to a tractor.
The geodesic is not on the orbit. The orbit is the set of conserved charges.
Right.
Yeah.
The orbit?
Right. So I'm going to forget about the geodesic itself, but just quantize its conserved charges.
Wait. Are those charges quantized?
So it's a symplectic manifold.
Yeah.
It's a phase space,
right.
and therefore it can be quantized at least formally.
No, I'm just saying that E and Q are quantized, right? The charges are quantized, and they're coming from.
Yeah. So you could quantize the P and Q, and then look at the commutation relations of your charges, or you can just assume that the observables of your system are the conserved quantities. And you want to understand how those are represented in your Hilbert space. So
we know that because you're really talking about brains, so they're quantized.
And when I say quantized, I don't mean integer valued. I mean represented as an operator in some Hilbert space.
Yeah, well, but red means integer valued.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
You want to consider.
Yeah, sorry, there was.
Charges which take integer values, right? So this whole.
Yeah. Those are not actual charges of the black hole. The actual charges of the black hole are P and Q and K. Those are. Differential operators which commute with the motion.
What is this Q then? What are these charges? So you're looking at some orbit charges. What are the charges?
What can I say? I mean, you have an action of a group on a manifold, so you know how to define noted charges for symmetries of that manifold. So those are the ones. Right? I cannot say more. Thank you. So if you pick a geodesic on G3, it's like picking one element in the Lie algebra of G, which is this matrix of conserved charges.
I guess I'm trying to ask, what about the black hole?
So that picks out one orbit.
You say a point on this orbit corresponds to the GPS trajectory.
Yeah, so those charges contain. Well, let me write down the answer.
So this orbit is the space of GPS.
Yes, that's exactly the statement. Yes. So, well, let me skip this discussion about N equals 4.
From the point of view of group theory, is there anything special about this orbit?
So, if you have arbitrary geodesic motion, you would have the generic orbit, but supersymmetric geodesic motion picks particular orbits, which are these nilpotent orbits. Yeah, there's still a spectrum of them. So I'm going to describe that now. If you give me a bit more time. Okay. I mean, it's, okay, so so it's a general fact that that orbits, quadrant orbits of a group are, can be viewed as phase space. So if you take any element in the in this Lie algebra, you look at its orbit under G minus one JG. Alternatively, it's the quotient of the group itself by the stabilizer of this element, where it carries a symplectic form, which is the Kirchhoff constant symplectic form, where at, if you look around at the neighborhood of the point J, is just taking the commutator of two vectors in the Lie algebra, and you can see that it's non-degenerate. So if we take a general element of this group, like a diagonalizable element of SLN, then its orbit, its stabilizer is just U1 to the R, it's just the rank. So its dimension is the dimension of the group minus the rank. And you can check that that's always an even number. And in fact, it is the orbit that you get by generic geodesic motion on this manifold. Now, if this element is not diagonalizable but has some non-trivial Jordan part, non-trivial nilpotent part, then the stabilizer of this element is going to be larger, and therefore the orbit itself is going to be smaller. The nilpotent orbits are those for which the semisimple part vanishes, and you only are left with the nilpotent part. And so, okay. Now, this, so you have an whole spectrum of these nilpotent orbits of increasing dimension, and then you reach into the continuum of this semisimple orbits. So, for example, for SU2, one, the maximal nilpotent orbit has the same dimension 6 as the generic orbit 8 minus 2, but there is a smaller orbit, which is in fact the smallest, which has dimension 4. So in this case, the statement is that the BPS phase space is actually this nilpotent orbit of dimension 6. Now, there is a general method that allows to quantize those orbits, or a general philosophy at least, that all the representations of G may be obtained by quantizing these quadrant orbits, by quantizing the Hamiltonian action of G on this quadrant orbit. In other words, you want to replace the conserved noted charges, which were functions of P and Q, which are like symbols, by differential operators acting on functions on that orbit. So the statement then is that the Hilbert space of supersymmetric black holes is going to be the unipotent representation associated to these nilpotent orbits. Okay. So, I guess I already went over time. Yeah, those are unitary representations. And infinite dimensional because all the groups we're considering are non-compact. So, how much time do I have? Am I free to leave?
You're not free.
Okay. Okay, well, yeah. Let's see how I'm doing here. I have to skip some material, I guess. Okay, so now we want to quantize this geodesic motion. So the first thing that comes to mind is that we need to replace these classical trajectories on that space by the wave functions on that same space, satisfying the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. That should be equal to 1 here, at least that. Okay, let's not go. Yeah, okay, let's not go back to that. No, if you take the geodesic to be lifelike, this delta is equal to 0, then there is a cancellation between the p square and the 1 here. Okay, so this would be for an ordinary particle, but we are dealing with a superparticle because we are reducing the full supergravity in four dimensions. And so the wave function is really a section of the spinner bundle on this manifold, or equivalently a set of differential forms. Now this is still the general solutions. Now if we want to truncate to the supersymmetric ones, then we need to quantize the stronger condition, which was the existence of a preserved Killing spinner. So this is the quantum version of the previous equation, VA alpha epsilon alpha, which I was writing down. So this field bind is an element of the tangent space, which gets replaced by a covariant derivative. And so essentially we're looking at functions which are invariant, which are independent of one half of the coordinates, this epsilon being just a doublet. So in other words, there should be a holomorphic function with respect to the complex structure determined by this choice of epsilon. Yes, please.
Could you just say again, I mean, why are we quantizing these classical solutions? You start with classical spherically symmetric solutions,
right,
these supergravity equations. And why should we just quantize those? Those aren't going to be the states of the black hole.
They're going to be the states of the black hole in a dual channel, in a radial channel. And we're interested in finding the states of the global time evolution. But we don't know how to do that. We don't know what's the gauge theory and the boundary of ADS2. But we could try to get at this information by quantizing in the dual channel and taking the overlap of a state at each of the two boundaries. So this is the Hilbert space I'm considering.
So you're saying that there'll be enough information just in this very restricted supergravity to reproduce the entropy?
Well, in principle, I should quantize, you know, all complete gravity in this channel, in this radial channel. Here, I'm making the assumption that the solution is spherically symmetric. So, of course, I'm throwing away a lot of information.
Well, normally the states of the black hole are not describable just in terms of supergravity. We've got to put all the sort of string theory, you know, the brains and the configurations in. We don't have different supergravity solutions for each microstate of the black hole in this case.
Well, in the same way as there is not a one-to-one map between open string states and closed string states. Those are different objects. Yeah.
But you're going to get enough states in some open space.
I'm not going to get the entropy by counting the states here, because the spectrum of the open string Hamiltonian is not the same as the spectrum of the closed string Hamiltonian. So I'm not planning to count the states of this radial quantization. I'm just planning to compute an overlap between states in this radial quantization to deduce a partition function for the time-like evolution.
So the overlap of these quantum wave functions should be the quantum
wave
too.
Right. Yeah, that's the idea from OVV. Yeah, it's not the usual way you would quantize black holes, for sure.
I mean, boundary states are not quantum wave functions.
Well, they are morally part of the Hilbert space. I'm not going to take the same psi on the two sides, but. So I agree that I'm also not very careful about the normalizability conditions I'm putting on my state. In the open-closed duality, you can still view the boundary states as formally into the Fock space of closed string states, even though they are not normalizable. Right. Is it okay? Or Right. So where am I? Sorry, I just argued that for general n equal 2 complexifications, n equal 2 black holes, then the wave function should be holomorphic, because of supersymmetry, should be a holomorphic function with respect to a particular complex structure. And the proper way of saying it is that it should actually be a holomorphic function on the twister space of this quaternionic Keller space, which appears in three dimensions. So this is, in fact, there is a well-developed theory of twister transform, which associates to the Schiff cohomology of that twister space, associates solutions of the Laplace equation and Dirac equation on this moduli space. So that's the general statement for n equals 2. And as I already mentioned several times, for the very special n equals 2 and n equals 4 and n equals 8, then we can use the symmetry structure to get a more explicit understanding of this Hilbert space. So we can, the general Hilbert space will be L2 of G mod K, because we have Jonsic motion at manifold. But we have to look for unitary representations of G inside L2 of G mod K, which satisfy the supersymmetric constraint. And furthermore, for each of these representations, rho I, we need to find a vector in this representation, such that by sandwiching, which gives a map between HI and H, from any vector in the representation V, I can construct a function on the coset by taking the sandwich with this spherical vector. So it turns out that there, in the math literature, Gross and Wallach have constructed exactly the kind of unitary representations that we are after. They were not aware of black holes, but they knew that there exist several orbits classified by the different values of the quartic invariant. And in fact, those are the various BPS orbits in state supergravity. So there is a very explicit construction of these representations by acting on the five grading of the group that I think I'll leave to Murat to explain because of lack of time. The minimal representation of smallest size, which should be relevant not for the 1/8 BPS black holes, but for the 1/2 BPS black holes, it turns out that we have constituted David Kajdan, myself, for totally different reasons. We are at the time interested in quantizing the membrane, but it turns out that these minimal representations are exactly the one needed for here. And in particular, we computed this spherical vector that I defined in the previous slide, and it's easy to see that in a particular limit corresponding to the net charge going to zero, then we indeed recover the topological string amplitude. So the So you asked me about what was the physical interpretation of this quantization. So let me spend some time on this. So as usual in quantum cosmology or in diffeomorphism invariant theories, when we have a wave function, because of the Wheeler-DeWitt equations, it's independent of time, independent of radius. So if we want to define observables, we need to use some other variable as a clock. So here, we want to imagine that we're doing a measurement on the black hole geometry as we go inward. So we're going to use the size of the time direction as a clock. Now this goes from zero at the horizon to a constant at infinity. Okay. And so we could extract information from the wave function, which is a function of this u, r, all the moduli, by looking at the given value of this time in u, and then computing inner products using the Klein-Gordon inner product, because we have a second-order differential equation. So for example, we could define an observable which would be the area of the S2. So if you look at the expression, it's actually not quite correct. Should be e to the minus 2 r squared, I think. This is just this what you read off from the metric. Now, this is an operator because u and r are quantum variables now. But you can take its vev in some state by integrating over those variables. So what you would, what should be possible to do is to compute the wave function of the area and see that it gets picked to the value predicted by the Bekenstein-Hawking, just the classical equations of motion as you follow the flow. And similarly, you could follow also the evolution of the moduli, of the black hole moduli, and find that they have some wave functions spread around the attractor value. Now, whether you believe it's a physical observable or not, I'm not very sure, but at least that's the meaning of this wave function, the practical meaning of them. I should also mention that there is the usual difficulties in quantum cosmology that this inner product is not positive definite, and you need to remedy it, for example, by performing a third quantization, which is the same as including baby universes in some way. So I think I used up my 15 extra minutes, but I just want to, just if you allow me for 5 more minutes, then I think I'll be able to start. So let's now go back to this OSV proposal and try to reinterpret it in this framework. So we had this overlap between two wave functions. It was not exactly clear why we should pick that particular one. And also, we have found that there is a natural extra charge, which is this net charge, K. So what we have understood is that the proper Hilbert space for the quantum attractor flow is a subspace into the full space of functions, okay? And it has a distinguished vector which allows to map that particular state into H by this formula. So I gave you some circumstantial evidence that this spherical vector was in fact the topological string amplitude. So I think that's the group theoretical meaning of the string topological amplitude. It does suggest, however, that the complete, there should exist a generalization of this topological string amplitude, which involves this extra charge K. And it's unclear at the moment what it is.
You know, what you mean the gain is zero? It's not true for the K3 times 2, right?
Yeah, I mean the gain is...
And also for the FHSV model, it's probably... Right?
Yeah, so... Yeah. So as I said, So I should have underlined circumstantial evidence. So I've put away all the higher derivative terms. I just told you how you could, in principle, introduce them, but I don't know how to quantize them. So this is the claim. Let's put it as a conjecture, which is supported by the evidence I displayed. But I think this should be the right framework. Yeah, right. Okay.
I think we know it's not true if you just say that it's a topological thing. Well, maybe I don't understand your psi of t. I certainly don't understand your psi of t well enough. But
well, I think you'll agree that...
But I'm just saying that K3 times T2 and FHSV...
I understand.
Where the moduli is classical moduli is very physical. I think we know that the topological thing has to do with the one.
Because there are R-square corrections. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but so the claim then, which I've not proved,
is wrong.
Yeah. Okay. But if you included the effect of these R square corrections, then you could try and prove that this is indeed.
That's not to say that there isn't a group theoretical meaning here.
Yeah. So I claim this is the right. Okay.
What you showed us before was that you got the cube, you know, exponential.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But
yeah, it's a small circumstantial evidence. Yes. So as I said, this is work in progress, and you know, we're still struggling with some issues. This one is maybe not the worst. Okay. So I started mentioning automorphic functions. Let me just outline what is the physical principle which would allow to select a vector invariant under this, a particular vector in this Hilbert space now. So the topological amplitude sits here, but you still have a freedom to determine what you pick in your Hilbert space. And I claim that there is one unique vector invariant under this three-dimensional Udalite group, and that's the one which is natural to choose if you want to reproduce black hole degeneracies which are in agreement with U-duality, with a discrete version of U-duality. And in fact, if you look at this formula, this is in fact the general presentation of automorphic forms on G mod K mod, this should be GZ on this side. For example, the Jacobi theta series falls.
G of R in the middle?
Yeah, this is a typo. GR, GZ. So, the real structure, K depends on the real structure, but G3 of Z and G3 of R do not depend on the real structure. I mean, do not depend on whether you did a time like reduction or a space like reduction.
But really, you're doing space like
reduction. So, certainly, if you want to define automorphic forms, you need to have a Riemannian space, not a non-commutative manifold. As far as I know. So what I want to claim is that this is actually the natural framework, natural arena for automorphic forms to arise. For example, the Jacobi theta series falls into this picture by choosing as the representation rho the metaplectic representation, which is, you know, x squared, d squared, and x dx. By choosing as the spherical vector the vector which is invariant on the compact subgroup, which is the harmonic oscillator, so this is the Gaussian, and then the finite part, the part invariant under SL2Z, in this case is just the sum of deltas of delta distributions at the integer values of m of x. And what you can show is that if you extract the Fourier coefficients from that modular form, you get the formula, which is in fact very similar to OSV, where instead of having the topological amplitudes on both sides, you get these two spherical vectors, one being the real spherical vector, which is conjectured to be the topological string amplitude, but the other one is this GZ invariant spherical vector, which I would like to call the adelic wave function of the universe, because in fact it can be obtained by adelic methods in the same way as this.
That is,
so this should be omega pq. This is those are the Fourier coefficients associated to this model, to this automorphic form, with respect to a particular parabolic subgroup. So Z black hole. But theta hat is the Fourier coefficient. So
I know,
I'm saying that omega pq should be the Fourier coefficient.
The Z black hole in the sense
of. Oh, in that sense. Yeah, that's right. In fact, you're absolutely right. It was this formula here. It's just saying on the left hand side is Z black hole, and this is modulus square of. That's right. Okay, so I'm sorry for going over time. There are some obvious directions for further work: understanding higher derivative corrections, understanding multi-centered black holes or rotating black holes. There is a similar story that you could develop in five dimensions. It's an important problem to relate this proposal, which is rather formal, to relate it to the other counting formula at a DVV, for example. I think a very interesting direction is to understand how this works for genuine n equal 2 theories, and is there any relation to a conjecture put forward by Maxim Kontsevich about the Fourier invariance of the topological string amplitude. And finally, well, the usual caveat, and this is restricted to time-independent BPS states, and black hole physics is about something more than that. So thank you very much for